This is an evening of storytelling by Pat McClear and Tom Cosgrove, and it's sponsored by PFLAG Juno. You also get to hear a couple of songs from the PFLAG Juno Pride Chorus, and that's who's up here on the stage with me, or a part of it. I'm Marsha Buck, and I'm the treasurer of PFLAG Juno. And for those of you who don't know, PFLAG stands for Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. There's been a PFLAG chapter here in Juno since 1995. So we've been around for a while, and we've been here advocating for gay, lesbian, bisexual family members, friends, and gay, lesbian, bisexual people themselves. PFLAG nationally has, between 400 and 500 chapters now, and the goal of all the chapters is to support family members, friends, and GLBT people themselves in a climate that's not always very friendly. It's also to educate an ill-informed public, often ill-informed public, and it's to advocate at the legislative level for equal civil rights. When Tom and Pat came to us and asked if we would sponsor this evening of storytelling, we were delighted and said yes, because this is part of the PFLAG mission. It is education, and it fits very well with what PFLAG is doing. So we're very glad you're here, and we're very glad they asked. Some of you may know that PFLAG has sponsored the Juno Pride Chorus since 1997. The Juno Pride Chorus is a chorus of women. There are about 40 of them, 40 of us, I should say, in the Pride Chorus right now. But we tried once before several years ago and found 40 don't fit on this stage. So tonight you're just seeing an ensemble of 12 women from the Pride Chorus in the first song. And in the second song, we'll have a duet from two women in the Pride Chorus. And then after that, we'll hear some storytelling. Leslie Wood is the director of the Pride Chorus, and you'll see Leslie. She's down here. Yes. And Jackie Farnsworth is the pianist. And then tonight we have a special treat because the first song is called The Gender Polka. A polka needs an accordion player. So we have an accordion player tonight for the very first time. And her name is Mary McEwen, so welcome, Mary, to the group. Welcome, Mary. The first song is called The Gender Polka, and you may want to laugh uproariously in the song, we hope. The lyrics are funny, but keep listening well as you laugh to The Gender Polka. And then after that, there will be a duet by Mary Graham and Bobby Mitchell on the wonderful, touching bedtime story of Everything Possible. So let me introduce the Juno Pride Chorus, an ensemble from the Juno Pride Chorus.
No, it's not, but still it's got us doing the gender polka. Would you tell the wonder, is it a cosmic blunder? And they really will they see you doing it in their polka. Never fear if you upset them, and the danger of to get them. Probably you'll get to see them doing the gender polka. Almost everyone, hey, hi, ho, people need to know. Sexual identity is a very personal thing, you see. So a girl like what they seem to be, it's just a gender polka.
Gender polka. Hey! be the love you leave behind when you're done. And the only measure of your words and your deeds will be the love you leave behind when you're done.
You're listening to Coming Out. Stories of Action and Reaction, featuring storytellers Pat McLear and Tom Cosgrove, recorded live at the Goldtown Theater in November 2013.
So without any more from me, let me introduce you to Pat McLear.
Coming out of the closet is not a phrase that really worked for me. I don't see myself as having been hiding behind closed doors, but rather being out in the open wearing camouflage. You can't see me. It's not a fashion statement that I would recommend. The camo was loosely sewn with pieced lies. Well, we only had enough money to rent a one-bedroom apartment. It came furnished with a double bed. No. We're just roommates. She's dating a guy named, you fill in the blanks. And why can't you come home for Christmas? Work, I fibbed. Really, I didn't want to fly back to the East Coast. I wanted to stay in Seattle. I wanted to be with my girlfriend. It was a new relationship, and I was so excited. And I wanted to share this excitement with my family, but I held back. Why? Fear. Fear of all the things that did not happen when I took off the camouflage. My father, Charlie, wanted to travel to Alaska to visit me. I had let my mother know that I was a lesbian, but Charlie had yet to get the memo. And he was quite insistent about flying northwest from Boston to Alaska. And finally, in frustration, my mother just said, "We can't, she's a lesbian." And that's what Charlie was like, "Yeah, and what's that got to do with anything? You know, that's my daughter. I want to go see her." So they journeyed across. They stayed with us in our home. They had a wonderful time. So good, in fact, that they returned on more than one occasion with my siblings and their families in tow. And we have wonderful, cherished memories of those McFamily visits. When I was in the eighth grade, I had an autograph book. And in it, my father wrote, "Here's to my fourth daughter. Her name is Pat. She's one of the greatest, and that's that." My being a lesbian did not alter his opinion of me. Both my parents loved me unconditionally. So why did I hesitate to remove that camouflage? Oh, the drama of it all. Martyr for the cause, victim of societal ignorance. They didn't understand me. How could they understand me when I wasn't secure enough with my own decisions to share them with them, to sit, to have conversation, to gain understanding? Damn, I wish there had been a how-to manual. But it's not as though my parents didn't have a clue. Now, I didn't go to any dances, and I didn't date in high school. I spent the prom at the movies watching True Grit with my best friend. And to this day, Deb still does an awesome imitation of John Wayne. My first queer crush was on the dorm counselor when I was a freshman at the University of Massachusetts, Sheila, the older woman. Smart, athletic, funny. I loved hanging out with her. And at the end of that year, I cried and it was my father who consoled me as I left campus for the summer. When I returned my sophomore year, Sheila was on exchange to England. I missed her terribly. Letters and phone calls went back and forth, and I began to realize that I was in love. What to do? Who to talk to? Have you seen that how-to manual? So during semester break, I went over the pond. And there I was, so excited to be with Sheila. But I didn't know how to act. I didn't know what to say. Dare I reveal my feelings? No need. Sheila told me that she had walked in on her roommate who was with another woman and how disturbing she had found that. Crash. I was walking on glass. I pulled that camo jacket tight around me. I was terrified that if she knew the truth, that she would reject me as her friend. So I faked it. When I returned to campus for the second semester, I was the dorm counselor. And as such, was required to attend trainings given by the Women's Center on how better to understand and be sensitive to the women on our floors who may be lesbian. We were given 3x5 index cards and asked to write down a question about homosexuality. And then we passed them forward, and the presenters pulled a fast one on us. They shuffled up the cards and then redistributed them and told us that we were to read the question and begin our answer with the statement, "As a lesbian, I think." There goes the house mother. She left the room, refused to participate. The other counselors were stuttering. They were tongue-tied. They made no sense. My turn? "As a lesbian, I think it's none of your business." The dyke facilitators were thrilled. "Exactly," they crowed. I was pale. Did I just doubt myself? Then they asked us to list women that we loved. Psh, easy. Mothers, aunts, grandmothers, sisters. Well, that's where the others stopped. But I continued. Deb, Sheila. I was being honest. And I think that's when I outed myself to myself. The camo was momentarily off. And after a while, you'd go to put it back on, and then fearfully that putting it back on is scary, and you don't want to, and you want to take it off again, but it's just a slow strip tease until that fabric is frayed and transparent and ready for the rag bag. I mean, who was I kidding? Not many. But the charade did have some amusing moments. When I was employed at the AWARE shelter, myself and a coworker were headed north to Skagway for a training, and I was determined that I was going to reveal my sexual identity. So we got to the hotel room. Everything was set out. We were nice and cozy, and I decided this was the time, and I blurted out, "I'm a lesbian." Candace's response, "So's my mother." Truly, that was a comeback I had not anticipated. And then she followed that with, "And so's my older sister." So, you know, really couldn't top that. We went out to dinner, had a great time, and have been dear friends ever since. When I consider the hows and whys of my wearing camouflage, it's not often that the love and compassion did not trump the homophobia card. But it was homophobia, my own and others, that dictated too many behaviors and decisions. Marsha Buck very kindly asked me, what I thought of in terms of the advertising for this event. Was I comfortable with the word lesbian being connected with my name? And I said, I lived there for over 30 years, and if they don't know by now, they should. Let's go for it. And now, Tom Cosgrove.
So in 1990, my sister Trish, that's not Patricia and never, ever Pat, she came out as a lesbian to the immediate family. That's my mom and dad and the eight kids. We're kind of the standard Irish Catholic family. Trish was 38 at the time, and I was 33. It wasn't really a shock, but it was a bit surprising. It did explain a lot, though, not the least of which was her long-standing and staunch defense of sensible shoes. Trish came out in a letter. The original letter was sent to my parents, and copies a few days later were sent to the siblings. When I started to put together stories for this evening, I called Trish and I said, can I get a copy of that letter? I knew she had one because she's a historian at heart. She said, sure, no problem, and then promptly procrastinated the task. Well, after many numerous harassing phone calls and texts, she finally got around to digging through closets and through boxes, and she did indeed find the letter. But when she reread that letter, she told me I couldn't have a copy. She told me I could read it and take notes, but even after all these years, the words in that letter brought up emotions that were raw and powerful. So one afternoon in Seattle, I sat down at Trish's dining room table, and she handed me an HBO inner office mail pouch. A remnant of her employment at Comedy Central in New York City. And in that pouch was the letter. It was longer than I had remembered, and I read it through multiple times, jotted down notes, and here, in essence, is what it said. May 31st, 1990. Dear Mom and Dad, the path to health is built on truth and honesty, and I've come to believe that you are as sick as your secret. And it's time for me to stop keeping secrets. I've been hiding for years from you and myself. Hiding takes so much energy. I've hidden to the point where I couldn't get out of bed. There's no easy way to say this. I'm gay, a lesbian, and I was born this way. Sorry if it comes as a shock and I feel cowardly writing the letter, but I find it too hard coming out any other way. However, it was time to take the risk to tell you instead of continuing to stand in the twilight fearing all possibilities. Homosexuality is a part of who I am, and when I started coming out to friends, I realized that I needed to share that part of me with you. While my need to turn this over to you is overwhelming, there remains this enormous fear of exposure and rejection. I hope for a positive reaction. I fantasize about a grand realization. But really, I'm holding my breath. Although I want you to know I don't wish to be different than I am. Well, that's not exactly true. I wish I was more loving and less angry, but surprisingly, not less gay. I don't want this to be a taboo subject either, a family secret heard once and never discussed again. I want you to talk to me honestly about your feelings, concerns, and questions. Having no real idea of where you're starting from, I don't know how long a road it will be for you to reach acceptance. I can only hope that you will reach it, and I have faith that you'll try. When you're ready, let's talk or write. I look forward to our future, Trish. I really, really wish I could tell you that I handled this well. I did not. I wish I could tell you that I was supportive. I was not. It wasn't that I was anti-homosexual, I was just ignorant. My upbringing in my middle America world, there was absolutely no homosexuals. They were not recognized, identified, or talked about in any way. Now, looking back, I can see clearly now that people like my mom's friends from church, Bob and Bill, bachelors that shared a house and threw these fabulous themed dinner parties. They were gay, obviously, but my mom still won't admit it. It doesn't meet her Catholic worldview. I think she's choosing to be deliberately dense. In 1990, I thought I was open-minded about homosexuality. I had no hate in my heart, and I would never tolerate violence. But no matter what Trish wrote in her letter about being born gay, I was like a lot of people. I thought homosexuality was a choice. And being that we live in a place where you can make that choice, more power to you. Just keep it over there. And since it was a choice, I really had little patience for all this whining about being mistreated. Trish asked us to be honest, and boy, was I. I picked up the phone as soon as I finished the letter. Now, I got this problem where my mouth engages before my mind does. And as you can imagine, I've got regrets. As a result, Trish, out of all the phone calls she got after that letter went out, all her siblings and in-laws, she really recalls only two phone calls. One was from me, and the other one was from my sister Sheila. Sheila was so excited. She was ecstatic because now, no matter what she did, coming home pregnant with a tattooed biker would just pale in comparison. She was home free. And she remembers our conversation because it was so painful. I was one of Trish's more liberal siblings. I had I'd questioned authority and had broken the chains of my middle American upbringing, and she was looking to me to be one of the supportive ones. When I was in Seattle taking notes on this letter, Trish and I talked about this conversation for the first time since we had it. And the weird thing was is that neither of us could really remember any details except for one. And it was the use of a single word, and that word was unnatural. You know, I did not intend to be cruel. To me, it was a benign word. It reflected homosexuality's break from our evolutionary drive to procreate. But to her, it meant wrong, disturbing, perverse. She had had the courage to share who she was, and I lumped her with deviance. She looked to me for support, and I had cut her off at the knees. I do remember trying to salvage that conversation, to no avail. We hung up. I knew I had screwed up. I just really wasn't sure how. I'm from a family of writers, and in that HBO inner office mail pouch was not only Trish's original letter, but all the responses she received, and copies of all the replies she sent to those responses. A whole chain of correspondence, a stack over an inch high. Now, this really wasn't unusual for us. In the pre-internet days, we carried on a very lively corresponding life. We shared cartoons, witty comments, pithy thoughts, and more than one practical joke. I once received a card postmarked Paris, France. On one side was a picture of the Eiffel Tower. On the other side was a note from a woman claiming to have my child. Now, I'm a short, stocky guy. I got legs like tree trunks. And this woman claimed she knew it was my child because of the size of its legs. And and the child's age perfectly corresponded to a bicycle trip I had taken across France. I knew it was Trish. So in this spirit, I sat down to write a letter. But it couldn't be any kind of letter. On the face value, it was a note of apology. But the creative twist is that in the margins, I had written in red as if it had been reviewed and graded by an English professor. And here is that letter. Dear Trish, surprising news is not unlike an inaccurate hammer blow to the thumb. The initial shock quickly wears off and the pain is not long lasting. Adequate, not exceptional use of metaphor. You were brave to send the letter, and I hope things are beginning to settle for you. I had forgotten that honesty, by its nature, can be cruel. It's all in how it's delivered. It's the difference between a bully, a stand-up comedian, and a diplomat. Is this humor? I apologize for my lack of sensitivity. Your road is difficult beyond my comprehension, and I know I have a long way to go to broaden my understanding. Appears sincere, lacks conviction. Hang in there and please keep in touch. Creative ideas, witty articles, and challenging thoughts are always welcome in my P.O. box. Yours in adventure and seeking, Tom. Overall, fair attempt at conciliatory letter shows promise. C plus. When I reread that letter, it was amazing to me that my inner college professor really understood more than my conscious self. I mean, I still didn't get it. The only thing I knew was that I was the problem. I had to figure this out. I did not want to lose Trish. And Pat, please join me.
Picture this. Autumn, 1972, University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Entering freshman, majoring in, wait for it, physical education. Yes, I aimed to teach PE. So there I was on a campus that had more students than my hometown had residents. I'm living in an all-women's dorm. I'm majoring in PE. And I'm a bench player for the women's JV basketball team. I am surrounded by dykes. But I couldn't see them. They were in camo. The more self-aware I became, the more they came into focus. But it was confusing. There were women athletes, coaches, professors, who were praised for their skills and achievements in some circles and ridiculed in others because they were wearing sensible shoes. I was having a hard time trying to see my life after graduation. Where did I fit in? And then it happened. Lightning struck. Cupid's arrow hit the mark. The object of my affection reciprocated. And my vision was cleared. Pam was moving to Seattle, and so was I. How to prepare for the culture shock? I didn't have a clue. Communal households inhabited by women, spelled W-I-M-Y-N. Women who changed their names in accordance with their politics. Women raising children together. Successful professionals, trade workers, athletes, artists, political organizers. I was in awe. It was one thing to fall in love with another woman. It was another thing entirely to find myself in the middle of this lesbian culture with all its angles and facets. So there I was in Seattle, and one of the first things I learned was the phrase, the personal is political. And it went from one-dimensional on the page to 3D. You know the saying, anticipation is half the event? Well, that was Pam and I when we were preparing to go to a Holly Mear concert. I was so excited. So we're walking downtown Seattle. We're making our way to the theater. We're surrounded by Holly Mear fans. It was electric. And then pow, protesters carrying signs, yelling at us, yelling at me, quoting scripture, making sure I knew what the afterlife had in store for us. I was dumbfounded. They didn't know me. I was just some sweet young thing on her way to a concert, and they were damning me. I was scared, and I was sad, and then I got angry. For 3 years, I lived and learned in the Emerald City. But there was an expiration date on that relationship, and so I headed north to Alaska, following a new love. Exit big city, enter small town that was a capital city. And the circle of women that I hung out with was now under a broader umbrella. Feminist, both lesbians and straight women. Brilliant, hardworking, creative women who made things happen. And I was just thrilled to hang on to their coattails. Well, sure, we can have the women's prerogative meeting at our apartment. That's not a problem. Sweet Amazons need a place to practice? Come to our place. We'll have a potluck afterwards. That was up until we were evicted. I don't like your friends, he said. You can't evict me because you don't like my friends. I can and I will, because what are you going to do about it? Nothing, I said angrily through clenched teeth, and we found a new place to live. Karen Robinson, a woman with vision, conviction, and commitment, hired me to work with children at the AWARE shelter. I started out as an advocate, and then I was working with the DA's office, the troopers, JPD, on interviewing child victims of sexual assault. And then one of the officers, higher up in command, sat with Karen and said he could no longer work with me. He didn't trust me. I was a lesbian. I was flabbergasted. Did my work speak for me? I was ready to quit. We couldn't let one biased, prejudiced man jeopardize justice for the children. I was outraged, but what was I to do? And that's when Karen sat with me and told me all the things I needed to hear. We were working with love and compassion towards the best interest of these child victims and their families. We would not allow one ignorant individual to sabotage our efforts. It was Karen's use of plural pronouns that assured me that the next time I worked with that officer, that I had backup. I was not in this fight alone. When I left that job, that officer sent me flowers with a thank you note. Fast forward a couple of years, I go down to Berkeley, come back with a library degree and a new job at Glacier Valley Elementary School. At the same time, the University of Arizona had a long-distance library program, and several folks in town were taking advantage of that. It was before online classes, so Arizona would send up videotapes of lectures, and then a local librarian would sit and watch with students, facilitate conversation, distribute, collect work. I was the local librarian who sat with the students who were studying children's literature. Easy task. I love sharing books with kids and passing that joy on to adults. And then one evening, the lecture was about gay and lesbian books for children. The professor spoke about how highly controversial these books were. Heather Has Two Mommies, Daddy's Roommate. Class discussion was stilted. Did they fear offending me? All right, granted, I had a chip on my shoulder. Really, I had a block on my shoulder. I was defensive. Of course school libraries should have these books, and we will. I was helpless when I was evicted, but a straight ally came to my defense when my job at the shelter was threatened, and I knew I needed a straight ally now. If Glacier Valley was the only library with one of those books, then I could be accused of using my position to promote the gay agenda. This inclusion strategy needed numbers. Every elementary school had to have one of these books. Ann Simons, librarian at JDHS, a staunch defender of the First Amendment and willing to work for it. Ann and I sat, came up with a plan, and at the next district librarians meeting, Ann, as the team leader, brought out the two books, had us talk about them, and then she asked, which ones should we put in our collection? Why either was the question. Because all children have the right to see their families reflected in the books that they read, and families is in the second grade curriculum. Daddy's Roommate was reluctantly selected, but that was immediately followed with, oh, we don't have enough money to buy any new books. Really, 15 bucks for a hardcover? But Anne had brilliantly anticipated that response and offered to buy books for all the libraries. Deed done. What wasn't anticipated was that the district mail clerk would open the box of books and, being thoroughly disgusted, brought them to the attention of her friends, her family, her church group, and the superintendent of schools. And that, my friends, is when all hell broke loose. Complaints were filed, meetings were held, letters were written, threats were made. A librarian's car windshield was smashed. The Glacier Valley copy of Daddy's Roommate was burned. The fight was exhausting, physically, mentally, psychologically, spiritually exhausting. But as is the case in many of life's experiences, we are challenged to find the humor in the more difficult situations. In this illustration in Daddy's Roommate, the two men are standing one behind the other, embracing. The opposition labeled this sodomy. When I brought this to the attention of a coworker, he said, "No, now we can't have the kids line up single file in the hall anymore." When we were done laughing, we continued to strategize on how best to keep the books in the stacks. After loud, contentious, standing room only meetings at every elementary school, the Juneau School Board bravely voted to keep the book on the stacks. And a hard-fought victory for equity was reached. Amen. The partnership of the superintendent, the school board, and the librarians was given an award from the Freedom to Read Foundation for our firm stance in defense of our students' right to read. But at the end of that school year, the elementary librarians were informed that the following year our jobs were being cut to half-time. Coincidence? I was also told that I was being moved to a new building where I would be half-time librarian and half-time, well, it comes around full circle, P.E. teacher. I guess the higher-ups had never heard Meg Christian sing her ode to a gym teacher. She was a big, strong woman, the first to come along to show me being female meant you still could be strong.
In the years following Trish and my conversation, we ignored the gorilla in the room. Trish pretended like I hadn't been a jerk, and I pretended like I was a changed man. I wasn't there yet, but my gosh, I was trying. My children harassed me because I had this need to research everything, and this situation was no different. I jumped into the scientific literature, and after reading, it was clear to me, at that time there was no such thing as a gay gene, but there was clearly a biological component at play. There was no scientific consensus, but it was clear that, to me anyway, that my views could not be scientifically supported. But even if homosexuality is a choice, who cares? I had to finally embrace this espoused belief of free to choose. A couple years after the letter came out, I had the opportunity to be in Washington, D.C. on business. I stayed over for the weekend to visit an old friend of mine, Bill. I had contacted Trish, and she came down from New York City on the train to spend the weekend with us. We were standing in line at a theater for a first-run movie that none of us were really that interested in seeing. Trish, she was looking through the weekend section of Washington Post, just trying to find out what else we could do. Oh, my gosh! Suzanne Westenhofer's in town! Suzanne Wooster, who? Westen, what? Suzanne Westenhofer. She's a lesbian comedian that I worked with at Comedy Central. And she's in town tonight at George Washington University. And, oh, my gosh, in like a half an hour. We got to go. Bill and I looked at each other. Lesbian comedian? I wasn't too sure. Trish knew me well enough to know that I would balk at the $30 ticket price. So, tell you what, if I can get to Suzanne before the show, I know we can get in free. And if we can't get in free, we'll go do something else. I mean, we're not really interested in seeing this movie anyway. We hailed a cab and took off across town. We arrived at George Washington University at the auditorium 10 minutes before curtain. There was nobody outside the auditorium, and the box office had a sold-out sign. We hopped out of that cab, and Trish took off, went along the face of that auditorium, turned down this narrow little alley, and took us right to the stage door, the sixth sense of a former actress. That door was propped open to the warm spring evening, and there was nobody standing guard. I looked in. So do we just walk in? I don't see why not. So Bill and I followed Trish in the door. Now, we hadn't gone more than a few feet when we hear, "Hey, what are you doing?" And this big guy looms out of the darkness in a T-shirt three sizes too small. Trish is fast-talking him the best she can when we hear, "Trish, what are you doing here?" It was Suzanne. And she was thrilled to see Trish. "Are you coming to the show?" You know, we just found out about it, and, you know, we couldn't get tickets. Suzanne turned to the guy she was with, which is happened to be the producer of the show. And she says, "Hey, we take care of Trish? She's a good friend of mine." There happened to be four comp tickets left. The lights had already dimmed when we made our way down the center aisle. The Lisner Auditorium at George Washington University holds 1,490 people, and it was packed. Our seats were right in the front row. Now, I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, I knew she was a lesbian comedian, but I thought that meant she was a comedian that happened to be a lesbian. but she was a comedian that specialized in lesbian material. Now, she was a Vegas kind of comedian. She was extremely funny, but very vulgar. She left nothing to the imagination. I was not ready for this. It was overwhelming. As soon as I got over the shock of one statement, I was assaulted by another. At one point, she asked all the straight guys in the auditorium to identify themselves. There couldn't have been 10 hands up in the entire place. Now, Bill was obviously less traumatized than I was because his hand shot straight up. But me, I did not want to get singled out. Suzanne looked right at me. Please, please don't pick on me. Please don't pick on me. The terror in my eyes must have convinced her I'd be no fun. And she selected someone else to harass. By intermission, I was shell-shocked. I would not even have left my seat, but I really had to pee. When I spotted the men's room across the lobby, I saw the line of women snaking out the door and all the way across the lobby. Not knowing the protocol in this situation, I joined the end of the line. And tried to fit in. Now, I want to tell you something. That line did not move at all. After standing there for a few minutes dancing up and down, I made a bold move. I cut to the front of the line. I stuck my head into the men's room. Excuse me, is anyone using the urinals? Thankfully, nobody was. So as I stood there, easing nature, I was surrounded by women who were primping in the mirrors and waiting for the stalls, and I had to endure their good-natured ribbing about the advantages of standing and peeing. I fled without washing my hands. I caught up with Trish and Bill in the lobby, and we were just hanging out, waiting for the show to start again, and I was looking around. And I said, all of these women are gay? All of them? Trish was disgusted. Really? Really? I mean, for a guy who's smart, you're absolutely, totally clueless. Yes, they're all gay, every single one of them. I mean, it didn't seem possible. I mean, sure, some of them look like lumberjacks, but most of them were far from stereotypical lesbians. Some look like business executives, others like June Cleaver. There was every size, shape, style, and color imaginable. There was close to 1,500 lesbians in one place. And it struck me. This was big. This was huge. This was bigger than I ever imagined, and certainly bigger than I'd ever experienced. There must be lesbians everywhere. I think this experience was my karma, my fate. I was obviously there to learn, and since subtleties can be lost on me, I was given an experience that was far from subtle. We caught up with Suzanne after the show, and she gave me a bit of grief about my deer in the headlights look. I had purchased a souvenir t-shirt, had a picture of Suzanne and her tag phrase, which was, "Nothing in my closet but my clothes." She was kind enough to sign the t-shirt, and she added a little inscription to the woman I had just started dating. It said, "Mila, it's never too late." I still have this t-shirt. And even after all these years, you can still read the inscription. But there is absolutely no way I can fit in that t-shirt. But even though it's old and musty, I have never been tempted to throw it into the rag bag. Because to me, that t-shirt represents a turning point. It embodies a moment where I finally got it. And not in an intellectual way, but deep, visceral way. Homosexuality may have been hidden from me as a child, ignored by me as a young adult, but now I knew it was woven deeply into the world around me.
Sister Mary Anine was my first grade teacher. I loved her. That Christmas, I received my first nun doll. Guess what her name is? My family lived just shy of 2.5 miles from St. John the Evangelist Elementary School, and I would walk home, singing, telling myself stories, fantasizing, playing what if in my head. But during Lent, I would work the beads in my pocket. I prayed the rosary. A walking meditation known only to me, a young girl, scuffing her feet on her way home from school. The autumn of my sixth grade year, my sister Mary, 7.5 years my senior, entered the convent. Instead of a cedar hope chest filled with treasures, like our two older sisters, Mary had a large black trunk with all the items checked off her packing list and labeled with Sister Mary McClear. I was so excited. It was as if she was living my dream and I was living vicariously through her. The mother house, her new home, was over the state line in Rhode Island, and the day that she entered, we were dressed in our Sunday best to deliver her to Mount St. Mary's. It was a beautiful, sunny, warm New England fall day, but really the weather was of no consequence. Mary and I were both radiating light and warmth, and I was so very proud when I watched her walk down the aisle of the chapel in her novice habit. It was as though I was standing right beside her. Mary never spoke her final vows. The Sisters of Mercy are a teaching order, and Mary is not an academic. One evening, while we were eating supper, the phone rang, and she asked to come home. And of course, my parents left immediately to retrieve her. I left the table, unexcused, dishes unattended, and went outside to play basketball. Took me a long time to forgive my sister Mary for puncturing my dream. Took me a long time to talk to her again. But eventually I came around. The local Knights of Columbus would sponsor an annual essay contest. When I was in the eighth grade, the topic was my vocation. I wrote, I rewrote, I read it aloud to my sister Mary, I edited and I won first prize for my essay on why I was going to be a nun. At the award ceremony, my teacher, Sister Mary Everett, came forward to congratulate me, and my mother looked her straight in the eye and said, "Damn you, you won't get another one." Oh, how I wish the floor would have opened and swallowed me up. I didn't know my mother didn't want me to be a nun. I didn't know what my mother's hopes and dreams were for me. She never said, but the nuns did. At Bishop Feehan High School, I was educated by highly educated women of faith. It was post-Vatican II. The women's movement had new life, and many in the Catholic Church were involved with liberation theology, social justice. I continued to contemplate following the lead of these nuns despite my mother's disdain for religious life, but I was unsure. And it was college that turned the page for me. The more I became aware of feminism and the women's movement, the more awake I was to my own sexual identity, the less a patriarchal theology met my spiritual needs. Really, there's a God who favors one set of genitalia over another? Really, a God of compassion and love would bless a union between a man and a woman and damn one between members of the same sex? I no longer was comfortable at Mass. I explored other faiths and beliefs, but nothing resonated. It was as though I had pulled anchor and was drifting without a compass. And it created a spiritual void. And over the years, that void ached. After I landed in Juneau, I was at Northern Light Church. I was helping to set up for a concert. And I was on the altar. I was behind the pulpit. I was looking out at all the pews. And it was as though a weight had lifted. And I think Emily Dickinson knew how I felt when she wrote, "I've ceded. I've stopped being theirs." And I was ready to start exploring again in an effort to fill that spiritual void. So there were full moon ceremonies with friends. There were Wiccan rituals with a small group of women. But nothing resonated. The rituals took a lot of planning. They were infrequent. As a group, we lacked commitment. And so the void continued, as did the ache. I asked for and received a leave of absence from the Juneau School District, and I went back east where I could work as a full-time librarian. And one day I was driving home from school, and I had an NPR driveway moment. The reporter was talking about Unitarian Universalism, of which I knew nothing. And the reporter spoke about how the congregations were striving to be welcoming. None of this hate the sin, love the sinner hypocrisy, but rather homosexuality is not a sin. Homophobia is. Get out! To the Yellow Pages. Where can I find one of these churches? And at the very next Sunday, I'm in the back row. I am soaking it all in, wide-eyed, ears and heart open. I was surrounded by families who looked genuinely happy to be at church. Families with youth and children and elders, conservative dress next to those who were pierced and tattooed. The speaker that day was a rabbi. 12 years of Catholic school, I never heard of Jesus referred to as a Jew, never mind have a rabbi as a speaker. And during announcements, a meeting for queers was declared. Hello, really? They said queers in church and nobody flinched. Serendipity, perhaps, but I had found a spiritual home. That void was now filled with a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And that patriarchal dogma that I had forfeited all those years earlier, well, that had been replaced with a covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of all people. The UU's Practice Truth in Advertising, Kim and I were married at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Burlington, Vermont. The officiating minister, an ex-Catholic nun. Sister Mary Anine has company, I do admit, to having a small collection of nun dolls. In our yard, there's a statue of the Virgin Mary and one of Kuan Yin, both of which are surrounded by threadbare prayer flags, waving their multiple intentions off to the universe. My Sister Mary is still a communicant at St. John the Evangelist Church, where she is a tireless volunteer for the St. Vincent de Paul, keeping it vital in our hometown. She and I are on parallel religious paths, each respecting and honoring the other's choice. And on any given Sunday, I can be the lay leader on the altar at the Juno Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and I think with gratitude about all those nuns who touched my life, and I think, if they could see me now.
Trish and I have traveled far since my introduction to lesbian comedy. As a matter of fact, just this past Memorial Day, I was lucky enough to attend her wedding. Trish married her longtime partner, Pam, and now their marriage is officially recognized by the state of Washington. Maybe not in the eyes of the law, but Pam has been a member of our family for years. She is the calm to my sister's storm. She's my kid's favorite auntie, and she is a valued in-law. Our family would be less without her. The wedding was a small affair in the backyard of my sister Sheila's house in West Seattle. They wanted a small wedding because, frankly, they've had several. In 2004, they got married in the state of Oregon, only to get a letter later informing them that the Oregon Supreme Court had nullified their union. Sorry for the confusion. But it was their very first wedding, or more accurately, their commitment ceremony, that was truly memorable. And it happened on a Memorial Day also, 16 years ago. On a Circle Line boat in the middle of New York Harbor, Trish and Pam stood up in front of a group and pledged their commitment. And a good chunk of this group was my extended family. Not just my parents and my siblings, but aunts and uncles and cousins. Now, not all of them were hip to what was going down, but they were all there to support Trish. And the party afterward was legendary. You can talk to anyone who was there, and they will tell you it was the best party they've ever been to. One of my memorable moments was floating at the foot of the Statue of Liberty and dancing with all my cousins and the good chunk of the New York City lesbian community to the thumping strains of the Village People. It was wild on so many levels. My date to this function, I took Mila, who is now my spouse, then the woman whose house I was living in and thinking of maybe committing to. We'd been dating for 4 years and living together for two. We'd actually talked about getting married the year before, but when Mila actually started wanting to plan a wedding, I kind of got cold feet. She got frustrated, said a few choice words, and told me the ball was in my court. We were on the way back from the commitment ceremony. We were flying nonstop between JFK and SeaTac in a Boeing 747. We were right up in front in the nose in first class because Mila had excess miles. I had finished my second Bloody Mary when I screwed up the courage. So, what do you say we get married? Mila was cool. I think we've had this conversation. And the problem with getting married is that you have to have some kind of wedding, which is something that you have an absolute inability to discuss. Okay, good point. I agree. I understand. But I think I got the solution. A stealth wedding. Oh my God, I got to hear this one. Okay, listen, here, we just coming from this wedding, this commitment ceremony, it was absolutely beautiful. It was wonderful. I mean, it was touching. It was in a beautiful spot, and all of my family, we met all kinds of great people, an incredible party. But you know what? There is no way I can do that. If I'm going to get married, I need little lead time and few, if any, planning decisions. Go on. Okay, so here's what I think. I think we should get married on our kayak trip. My birthday kayak trip? Yeah, that's the one. The one we're having in like 2 weeks? Yeah, that's the one. It would be perfect. Listen, you know, we got some good friends coming along, and my sister Sheila's coming up from Seattle, and we get somebody to secretly sign up as a wedding commissioner, and voila, stealth wedding. She was unconvinced. But by the time we landed in SeaTac and she had had a couple glasses of wine, it was a done deal. We got a good friend of Mila's, Mary, to sign up secretly as a wedding commissioner. We got inscripted some friends to run out party supplies the day of the wedding in a skiff. And we even got the court clerk to hold the announcement in the paper a week, so it would not show up until after we had left. So, we're out in Berners Bay. Beautiful day. We've been paddling all around. And when the group got to the Berners Bay cabin on that beautiful sand beach there, we got out and announced we were getting married the next day. And the crowd went wild. Oh, they were so excited, running around, cleaning the cabin, getting ferns and stuff out of the woods to decorate and driftwood sculptures. I mean, it was a lot of fun and few planning decisions. So the very next day, the day after Mila's birthday, on a beautiful Southeast Alaska day, we walked down that beautiful sand beach in our extra tufts. And under a phalanx of raised kayak paddles, we were married. The guest book was a dollar bill. This past Memorial Day at Trish and Pam's latest wedding, I was one of the few relatives in attendance. And so I was asked to give a toast. The first part of the toast was an abbreviated version of the story that I just told you. And it ended like this. Come on, everyone. I want you to raise your glasses to Trish and Pam. Come on. Don't be sticks in the mud. This is an important moment. Yeah. I want to say thanks because I followed your lead. And 16 years later, Mila and I are still devoted. We've got two wonderful children and a nice house on B Street in Juneau. And I want everyone here to know that it took the example of a loving and committed homosexual relationship to get this heterosexual to marry. Salute. First of all, I want to tell you she's a great woman to work with. But what I want to say is that we are at a momentous time in our culture, a time of great change, a time many of us never thought we would see. In the course of my lifetime, I've gone from a childhood where homosexuality was invisible to having children who think it's no big deal. They don't blink an eye at a family with two kids, two moms or two dads. But in the bigger world, it was only 2 short years ago that it looked like the pendulum had swung so far that gay marriage would remain a quaint artifact in a few liberal states. Now, there are lots of opinions about why this is happening, and I'm sure you've heard a number of them, but you haven't heard my opinion. And I think you're going to be shocked when you hear that I think things are changing because of stories. There's a huge segment of the population, people like me, people who are not by nature hateful or intolerant, but woefully ignorant. And we are being educated by people coming out to their family and friends, putting a personal face on homosexuality. These brave people have told their story, and their stories have changed the hearts of millions. Thanks to all of you.
You've been listening to Coming Out, Stories of Action and Reaction, featuring storytellers Pat McLear and Tom Cosgrove, recorded live at the Goldtown Theater in Juneau, Alaska, in November 2013. Also appearing was an ensemble from the Juneau Pride Chorus.